This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Downtown Eastside residents living in the city's derelict SRO hotels are dying at a rate more than eight times the national average. A UBC study followed residents in the single-room occupancy hotels over 4 years, tracking health issues and treatment. For participants under 60, the death rate was 10 times the national average. The risk is especially great for people living with a mental illness. We're joined this morning by one of the authors of the report, Dr. William Honer. He is head of UBC's Department of Psychiatry. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So tell us about the study. How and who did you recruit to participate in the study?
Well, the study actually started back in 2008. My colleague, Dr. Bill McEwen, who's the head of psychiatry at St. Paul's Hospital, was increasingly concerned about the patients he was seeing in St. Paul's and, you know, the high number of people from downtown Eastside who are using St. Paul's emergency room when they're in crisis and need help for their mental health conditions. So we started a study looking at people who lived in the SRO hotels, basically trying to get anyone who lived in a number of hotels to join the study. And we had a very good participation rate, actually, about 80% of the tenants would in a given hotel would agree to join the study. And so then we followed them. And really, the start of our study was the origins of it, you know, were to understand the problems they were having, what barriers they might have accessing healthcare and so on. But what became apparent was, you know, really, unfortunately, the high mortality rate of the people that we were following, you know, began since 2008 or so. And our original paper, original communication about this was about 2 years ago, where we, you know, had an inkling that the rates were much higher than we expected for a Canadian population, you know, if you match them for the age and gender, which are factors that influence mortality. And so this high mortality rate, most recently now, as more time has passed, and unfortunately the rate seems to be continuing unabated, we were able to identify some risk factors that seem to be leading to mortality in the group.
You say that people are dying at a much higher rate, either 8 to 10 times. Is that because there's more disease among the SRO population, or is it because they're not being treated?
Well, it's you know, we focused in this, in our research, on treatable risk factors. And again, just so the audience understands and so on, risk factor and cause of death are different things. So high blood pressure would be a risk factor. Having a heart attack could be the cause of death. And there's a range of different causes of death in the downtown Eastside. You know, some are due, very unfortunately, due to suicide, some due to drug overdoses. But I think the majority of causes of death in downtown Eastside are related to chronic medical illnesses, like they are in lots of the population. It's just shifted to a younger age at which these illnesses take their toll or so on. So we, by focusing, you know, not direct, and you get individual people, there were 31 people died in the course of time over our study. It's hard to focus on the individual causes of death and so on. We thought a strategy was much more to look at what were the risk factors, just like that example of, you know, if you treat high blood pressure, you should decrease the number of heart attacks you're going to be having. And so we focused on risk factors that could be treated. And, you know, HIV/AIDS is a risk factor that could be treated, could also be a cause of death, but it's a risk factor too. So we focused on things, you know, about 10 different risk factors that we thought could get treatment, and then sought to see, you know, to help address your question exactly, is it perhaps related to things that are being well treated and still they cause death, or are there things that could be treated and are not being treated and are increasing the risk of early mortality?
So you mentioned HIV. So was that something that was a big risk factor?
No, it wasn't actually. To our surprise, some extent, you know, going into it, we thought, well, you know, if you have HIV/AIDS, you'd be at higher risk for early mortality. But this does link then to our finding that, you know, two-thirds of the people when they joined our study who had HIV-AIDS were taking their antiretroviral drugs and were being treated for HIV-AIDS. We, of course, tried to get those who weren't in treatment, you know, connected back to the St. Paul's Clinic and getting their ARV drugs. Virtually everybody who had HIV-AIDS had been treated at one time, and sometimes they go off their medication, you know. Sometimes we help try to connect them back up, get them back on. So that risk factor, which we thought would be a risk factor, it was being treated. And so we thought, well, you know, maybe that is, we're doing a good job. Dr. Montaner's group and so on and others, you know, working in the downtown east side, providing the frontline care for HIV/AIDS, do seem to be doing a good job because it's not a risk factor for early death, in the, at least in the small cohort that we looked at. So that's an optimistic part of, you know, the story, really, in terms of the medical treatments that are being provided for people living in the downtown east side.
And I also understand you looked at substance abuse as a risk factor. What did you find there?
Yeah, again, we looked at opioid use, so, you know, heroin or morphine or those kind of drugs, and we looked at stimulant use, so cocaine, either crack cocaine or injectable powder cocaine, or methamphetamines, another stimulant drug. And again, we did not find that these were risk factors for early mortality. Now, people who are using opioids, many of them are or have a history of using opioids. About half of them, actually, I should say, not many, half, are being treated with methadone. So that's the replacement kind of treatment that the addiction medicine people and addiction psychiatry people use to help prevent relapses, to, you know, stabilize people who are who have had a history of opioid use, and some of those are still, you know, in the active phases of that kind of addiction, and they use methadone. So again, a treatment that is being used and is perhaps a factor, and you can't really link cause and effect in these kind of studies like we did, but at least there's an association between being treated and something not being a risk factor for early mortality regarding the addictions.
Okay, then what did you find were some of the bigger risk factors?
So the two that came through out of the 10, and we took into account, we looked at several, you know, the more you look at, the more likely you are to find something. So we took that into account with the statistics and so on. But what we found first off was that psychosis, so the one of the most severe forms of mental illness where people in some ways lose connection with reality. They either hear voices or they develop beliefs or things that hearing voices is an example of hallucinations. Or they develop beliefs that are wrong and you know are absurd or don't make any sense. These are delusions. So that kind of psychosis did increase the likelihood of dying early. The other thing that increased on the medical side that increased the likelihood of dying early was liver damage or dysfunction related to hepatitis C. Not just having had hepatitis C or being, you know, still having active hep C, but when it progressed to the early, really quite the early stage of liver dysfunction, where we could detect that by an indirect measure of some blood tests, that seemed to be increasing the risk of early mortality as well. Now, again, all those people who had evidence of liver damage didn't die of liver disease, but because that can, you know, increase the likelihood of having difficulties fighting off infection, or there's a number of pathways that risk factor can lead to early death, a direct one by causing, you know, the liver, if you die of liver failure, but there's indirect pathways too. Psychosis is very, very rarely a direct cause of death, but again, there could be indirect pathways where psychosis is increasing the risk of mortality as well.
So let's go to the hepatitis C. Why aren't people being treated for that?
Well, we have had for many years now some treatments for hepatitis C, the interferon treatment, and again, I'm not a, you know, not an infectious disease doctor here, so I'm a psychiatrist, but the infectious disease treatment for hepatitis C, the interferon treatment, involves a series of injections. It wasn't 100% effective in treating the hepatitis C, and often people who have mental illness will experience an exacerbation of depression or other kinds of symptoms related to the interferon. So it wasn't the best treatment for people with hepatitis C and these multimorbid conditions in the downtown east side. We do have new treatments now, though, that have just come out really and been approved, I would say, maybe in the last 6 months. These are orally active treatments, so pill-type treatments. It's about a 8 to 10 week treatment period. And these can, in many cases, apparently, really eliminate the virus from the system and could be curative kind of treatments. They are, however, very expensive. And there's a risk, too, if people are successfully treated for hepatitis C, but then relapse into intravenous drug use and needle sharing, so they could, you know, get the infection again or so on, that, you know, we really need to, I think, set up comprehensive systems that look at the whole person with hepatitis C and see, there's still some debate, I think, in terms of the priorities and of how severe the liver damage or dysfunction needs to be before a threshold is crossed that indicates these very resource-intensive treatments in terms of costs. Are indicated. Again, it's getting a little bit out of my expertise here in terms of the decisions that are made by the infectious disease or the medical side in terms of deciding when to treat with these very expensive medications.
And then getting back also to your point about psychosis, why are people that are vulnerably housed at higher risk of this risk factor?
Well, we looked at that. You know, it's probably about half of the people have a kind of psychosis that is related to their stimulant drug use. So drugs like methamphetamine and in some situations cocaine can lead to what we call a drug-related psychosis. It changes the messengers in the brain such that there's a period of psychosis, which can last quite a long period of time. Even after the initial intoxication with the drug, the psychosis can persist. The other half of the people don't seem to have a drug-related psychosis, but they have schizophrenia or other kinds of illness that really can, psychotic illnesses that can really impair your ability to work and form relationships and so on. And I think some of these unfortunate people, and they come from often very deprived backgrounds where they haven't, you know, had lived in foster care, these kind of things. And they really have drifted into the downtown east side. It's got cheap housing, and they can get some support for their housing there and so on. So it's about the other half of the people with psychosis probably have schizophrenia or conditions related to that. The real challenge is that we found of those who had psychosis that was, you know, quite obvious, only about a third were actually getting treatment with medications, which are indicated for periods of psychosis. And again, now we've got the link of not enough treatment and something being a risk factor that we're quite concerned about and hope we can, you know, advocate to do something different in the future, both linking, you know, on the housing side, working with the Mayor's Task Force and working with Vancouver Coastal in terms of trying to improve the treatment for psychosis.
So it sounds like if you have a mental illness, you really need a good support network and a stable housing to get the right treatment.
Yeah, I think in terms of, I would interpret your comment as a support network in the broadest sense, in that I think from the medical side, we need to treat patients in a holistic way, not, well, you go here for your methadone and you go and see that other doctor for your antiretroviral drugs or your hepatitis C drugs, and you go to see that other counselor for mental health, and you go to see the psychiatrist once a month for a medication renewal or so on. You know, that we need to have integrated treatment that looks at all those things together, because, you know, as we talked about in terms of, you know, maybe these new hepatitis drugs, they could have interactions with other drugs. We don't know enough yet to know if there will be perhaps side effects related to people with mental illness being treated for the hepatitis C. We need to monitor that and ensure that we do our very best so there's not relapse into risky behaviors that could lead to reinfection. So I really am making a plea for much more integrated treatment. Be great if we can have low barrier methadone access, but that, you know, should be integrated with treating the patient as a whole and the range of problems that they have, not just a focus on one of the problems at a time. We need to look at people comprehensively.
Well, William, I want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. William Honer. He is the head of UBC's Department of Psychiatry.